Hi, Simon Hill here. Enjoy our podcast? If you'd like to help us keep delivering the sort of quality football chat you want, then you can show your support by making a donation. Big or small, however much you can afford, we appreciate all your help, and every cent will be ploughed back into improving production. Thanks in advance from all of us at Shim, Spider, and so much more.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Shim, Spider, and so much more. Take it away, fellas.
Yes, hello again. Good to have your company for the weekly edition of Shim, Spider, and so much more. A week when the clubs seem to bypass the PFA in their negotiations with the players over pay cuts. The Newcastle Jets and Central Coast Mariners set for new owners. While overseas, the English Premier League battles with the coronavirus spike. Manchester City get hammered by Leicester. We are socially distancing here on the podcast too. We're taking no chances with me in Sydney, Zeljko Kalats in Greece and Craig Moore in Scotland. We reckon we've got the 1.5 metre thing well and truly covered. Good to see you, boys. How are you?
Good morning. Or should I say good afternoon or whatever time it is. Hello, everyone.
Yeah, good morning, good afternoon, good evening.
Yes, I don't think any of us know what time it is in the various parts of the world that we are. Let's just kick things off. The CBA, Maury, we've covered this quite extensively over the last couple of weeks, but is bypassing the PFA becoming pretty much the only option now for clubs and players and trying to sort out deals individually? I know Perth, of course, have carried through on their threat of standing players down as well. James Johnson sort of waiting on the outside in the wings, ready to go if necessary. What's your take on all this?
Yeah, look, it's a really tough situation. We've kind of touched on it in a couple of our podcasts. Look, whether or not the clubs obviously feel that bypassing the PFA is a way forward for them. Look, it's a tough time, Simon, for everybody. And clubs are trying to take, I guess, control of their financial situation with still all of the uncertainty. A lot still to play out here. I just hope we can get to a really quick resolution for the players, for the clubs. I mean, financially, everybody is hurting. We also know that the pain that they're experiencing here in the lower leagues, the EFL here in England. So tough times for football, but CBA, in terms of protection of players, is obviously the best way forward, but they seem a long way off that, don't they?
Indeed. Yep. Spider... Zanti, your club, you're raiding the A-League, mate. In Josh Berlanti, Callan Elliott. It's becoming an Australian Zanti FC.
Oh, you forgot Matt German arrived Saturday night as
yeah,
well.
Oh, sorry. Forgot Matty.
Yeah, that's all. Matty German arrived Saturday night. We did try Paul Izzo, but it just didn't happen.
Still not happening, Spides?
Nah, it didn't happen, mate. We tried our hardest, to be fair. The owner and the people in charge, they really pushed for it, but we just couldn't get it across the line. So that was unlucky. But yeah, we're still looking. We haven't stopped yet. We're still looking.
Okay, it's going to become like a little Bali, isn't it? In Zanti, all those Aussies clustered around the pool and the beach. Let's get into it then, and we'll kick off with Simon Says.
Simon Says.
Well, Football Queensland this week released its strategic infrastructure plan for the next 4 years after a statewide consultation process that, surprise, surprise, revealed the game of football suffers from a lack of investment. FQ's paper outlines three priorities in terms of infrastructure in particular. Firstly, a home of women's football and centre of excellence in Queensland. Secondly, regional high performance centres. And thirdly, a boutique stadium of 15,000 with three potential sites. These developments are obviously to be applauded, as is the news on Friday that more than a dozen clubs in the state have been approved for over $350,000 worth of funding to upgrade their facilities. Now, the hosting of the FIFA Women's World Cup in 2023 accelerates these opportunities for the game, and it's long overdue. Yet what still concerns me is the language used in the release, specifically this with regards to the boutique stadium. The proposed stadium would provide a high-performance facility for football matches and other sporting codes, featuring a new pitch designed for multi-purpose use. Similarly, Tasmania is hoping the Women's World Cup acts as a catalyst for investment into York Park in Launceston. But the initial proposal is for the capability of bringing seats in to convert the current oval into a rectangle temporarily, aka Marvel Stadium in Melbourne. No, please no. At the moment, 13 stadiums are listed as host venues for the 2023 World Cup. You know who they all are? Out of all the stadiums, though, only one could be said to be a pure football venue, Coopers Stadium in Adelaide. The rest are the usual mix of league, union, AFL, cricket and football, and we know where we normally sit in the pecking order when it comes to those sports, when it comes to stadium deals and pitch quality, etc., etc. But this is a World Cup in Australia, a football World Cup. Football is the sport that is delivering the global stage, those global dollars. And I think what most football people want is a real legacy for our sport from that event. That's not to say other sports shouldn't be played at those venues, but we have to learn from history and this time be fully in charge. My journalistic colleague Sebastian Hassett recently wrote a very telling article regarding the 2000 Olympics and how the Gabba, which hosted seven football games as part of the Sydney Games, used the presence of our sport to drive upgrades. Upgrades which have since benefited almost every sport bar football. Hassett pointed out that out of the $6.9 billion spent on Olympic infrastructure, the only money that came football's way was the $30 million upgrade of Hindmarsh, and that the tenant clubs Adelaide City and West Adelaide were even initially asked to help cover construction costs by way of a ticket levy. 15 years later, 20 times that amount was used to upgrade Adelaide Oval. Back in Queensland, Brisbane Roar, who to be fair have a $9 million council-owned training facility in Logan, are reportedly now having talks with the Gold Coast Suns to move their training base to Carrara, a facility developed to the tune of $144 million for the AFL team. Meanwhile, check out the different language used when it comes to rugby league in New South Wales. Just last month, New South Wales Deputy Premier John Barilaro offered his government support for five new boutique stadiums. Here's his quote. "The government has an appetite for the ground renewal program that the NRL has put forward. If we do three, four or five more Bankwests, well, that's got to be great for the game long term. Great for the community and great for that competition." Which game? Which community? Which competition? Not ours, clearly. And while there's no doubt football would get some benefit from investment in boutique stadiums in New South Wales and Queensland, I'd urge the game's leaders to follow the NRL and AFL's lead in being much more aggressive in pushing our case. We're the biggest participation sport in the country. We have a sport that has been historically, chronically underfunded. We have few true homes. And we have a Football World Cup coming here in 3 years' time. If there's money going spare for infrastructure, then no disrespect, but it shouldn't be for AFL or for NRL or for cricket. They've had plenty down the years, or even for men or women or sport in general. It should be for football. If we don't fight harder this time, then I fully expect in 10 years' time, I'll be walking around some plush facility in Brisbane, which should have been for football, but will have miraculously turned into yet another stadium for another sport. And let's not forget what's happened too to two of our most historic football stadiums in this country, Middle Park in Melbourne is now a pit lane for the Australian Grand Prix, while St George Stadium in Sydney lies derelict and unloved. Please don't let it happen again. This time, it's got to be football first. Let's move on to Hard Talk.
Hard Talk.
Hard Talk is brought to you by Streamgate, which has been live streaming since 2008, specialising in custom-built stream pages, pay-per-view and multi-language streaming. They can cater to large online conferences with multiple simultaneous streams and destinations, including all social media channels servicing clients Australia-wide. Go to streamgate.com.au or find them on Instagram. Well, more Ian Spider news this week that both the Newcastle Jets and the Central Coast Mariners are pretty close to being sold. Now, the rumour was the Jets were going to be bought out by a company called Sky Jade, which is a company based down in Melbourne. My understanding is that that is far from being certain, that there is interest elsewhere. Meantime, the Mariners look like they're going to be sold to Sydney-based investor and technology businessman Abdul Halu, who wants to keep them in Gosford and who also has a stake in Rayo Vallecano over in Spain. What do you make of these developments with regards to our two regional clubs?
For me, very positive on both sides. I mean, at the end of the day, we've spoken about it. If we have good investors that are willing to continue and take over the clubs and help sort this problem out that we're in, that's only good for the game.
Maury?
I'm saying, look, we're desperate for investment in the game. We need investment in the game. So, look, not saying that you take anybody's dollars. Governance, due diligence is very, very important. But I think it's exciting that we do have people out there that want to invest in our game, Simon.
When it comes to due diligence, boys, I don't know if you know the answer to this question. Who does that? Is that James Johnson or Chris Nicu or the boards? Who does that investigative work?
Look, it should be, Simon, it should be all of the above that you've mentioned. You know, what I think is the way forward in terms of the due diligence is really digging deep into the background of the people, previous businesses, certainly what that looks like over the previous 5 years. And I think that not only in Australia, but worldwide now, I think some form, when you're getting investors to come into the game, I think there should be some money put aside also in a trust or a fund in terms of, you know, when the game, if it hits financial stress and they're unable to meet their financial responsibilities, that there's that trust there that can buy them out of trouble, so to speak. I think that's important as well, because something like COVID, nobody's seen it coming, but we look at it now and we look how much it's hurting our game.
Spider, can I ask you about whether we perhaps need clarity as well when it comes to our owners? Because after all, football clubs, you know, they're part of the community. The owners are basically just in charge of the club in trust for future generations, aren't they? And I ask this question because there is this strange tale this week down in Adelaide about the Reds being sued to the tune of $1.7 million in a dispute involving their former owners, particularly Bruno Marvejo, who's since been declared bankrupt. There's an article in the Adelaide Advertiser this week with journalist Michael Maguire asking again for clarification around who exactly the Reds owners are outside Pete Vanderpool.
I think worldwide you're pretty much who the owners are of the clubs. I mean, the big clubs in Australia, we all know. Mate, it's funny you bring that up, Simon. It's the one club I actually don't know who owns Adelaide. I've actually never known who owns them. I knew they had some sort of group of people, but I didn't know where they come from and what they were doing and what their businesses were. So, yeah, I think clarity would be good. As for the other clubs, I think it's quite clear who owns which clubs in Australia.
Hmm. Well, Pete Vanderpool, obviously, we do know down at Adelaide, but he remains the only person that is publicly out there as the owner, or at least part of the club ownership structure. Let's move away from club ownership and move on to the player merry-go-round, which continues, Maury, in the A-League. Andrew Naboot leaves Perth without ever kicking a ball for them and signed on for Melbourne City. He was playing for their big rivals, Melbourne Victory, of course, last season. James Donaghy has gone to India just weeks after signing for the Jets. I'm not even sure they officially even ever announced him. It's tricky for fans, isn't it, to build attachments to these players when they appear to move on so quickly and so frequently.
Well, especially now with everything that's happening, Simon. I mean, we're seeing some really strange movement. You know, I was aware of Donks going to Newcastle and then heard the news about him then going to India. And then I seen Newcastle follow up with that maybe a day or two after about it being a loan deal. But the challenge is obviously what we have for the Australian players is the downtime now, Simon. You got to remember, these are football players that are desperate to be involved and playing football. And because there's still that uncertainty of when we start. So for Newcastle, financially, it made sense probably to have a player getting games under his belt with Donks with some in India with the view to coming back. But you're going to continue to see this kind of movement between players and clubs, and where they end up and when we start and where that sits is all very interesting times ahead.
Yeah, but Maury, you know, you don't blame the players, do you? Like, I mean, the reality is they actually might not play football for another 6 or 7 months. That's not a professional footballer.
You know yourself,
when you have time off at the end of a season in Europe or South America, within 4 weeks, you're back in training. Now, we're saying to these guys, okay, go into a hub, spend the last 2 months playing this hub. We finish the season. Now, we're not going to play for 6 or 7 months and not give these guys the opportunity to grow and go elsewhere and play. It's normal that they're chasing opportunity. And there'll be more of them that'll leave, I'm sure of it, Maury.
Mate, 100%. They're professional footballers, Spides. They want to play football. That's what they're there to do. Look, the difficulty is for the clubs, and I'm having some conversations with the Australian clubs, is just still, unfortunately, that uncertainty. You know, everybody has got an idea potentially what the next 9 months is going to look like. But after the broadcast deal runs out, Spider, and what next season looks like, mate, nobody knows what's happening. That uncertainty is not good for the game, and therefore players are going to explore other opportunities.
Yep.
It is a very worrying situation for everybody concerned with football in Australia. Let's talk about some brighter news. Three or four pieces this week, in fact. First of all, good to see Nike and the FFA have found a way to make the Matildas away jersey available in a female cut after those howls of protest. And quite how that managed to slip through in the first place is beyond me. Aiden Trustich has joined Matt Leckie in the Bundesliga after signing for Eintracht Frankfurt, which is great to see. And I want to ask you, Maury, about Nikita Rukavica, somewhat the forgotten man of the Socceroos. He hasn't played for the national team since 2018. He scored 7 in 5 for his club side, Maccabi Haifa in Israel. And his goal has booked a Europa League playoff against Tottenham. Maybe greening all this not far away.
I think I've also seen some quotes recently from the assistant coach, Rene Mullerstein, for the national team, saying that he is a different type of player that maybe we don't have in the national team. I think Nikita may be about 32, 33 years of age, Simon, but he's well-liked and well-loved in Israel. He's scoring goals. He's doing it on a regular basis. He has pace. Obviously, in Australia, we've seen him more as a winger, but certainly in Europe, he's been predominantly played through the middle. He's having a great run, as did we see also Adam Taggart with a hat-trick over the weekend. Amongst the goals again. So it's good to see that outside of Australia, we do have our Australian players that are cracking on with their careers and doing well. But Nikita Rukavica should be in the thought, certainly, of the national team.
Whenever the national team gets to play a game again, of course. Spider, on Adam Taggart, Maury mentioned he scored that hat-trick for Suwon, big relegation battle at the weekend. They're battling against the drop, the Blue Wings. Taggart is reported as saying that he thinks it's time to leave the club. He wants to take the next step up on his career, which is probably understandable. Where's the best fit for an in-form Adam Taggart? Is it Europe? Is it elsewhere in Asia? What sort of level? What sort of club? Oh,
Zanthi FC would be fantastic.
Another one. You can't afford him, son.
I thought I'd just drop that one, you know what I mean? Look, I've always sort of tagged it as a very good goal scorer. You know, a little bit like Rukavica at the moment. He's probably found a great level for him. Like, he was a bit of a journeyman. Tags was a bit the same. And they find their sort of level and they find happiness in scoring goals. I don't care where you are, but as a striker, if you're scoring goals, mate, you're happy. What level is Tagger at? Look, I'd love to see him come to Europe. Mate, he's a good striker, and strikers are hard to find anywhere more. You know that. It doesn't matter which league.
Yeah, the issue is going to be Spides, right? Tags is on decent money where he is, right? So yeah. The club are going to certainly want to recoup some kind of money on the player. So it might not be a heavy transfer, but it'll be still a decent-sized transfer. And his salary. So that is going to be what dictates where Taggart ends up to. Is he a premiership player? Probably not. So all of a sudden you start to, I guess, you can rule out places where he won't end up. And I kind of feel that it probably leaves him in Asia, Spides. It probably leaves him in Asia to earn good money. But what that looks like, I don't know. What I do know is Tags is a goal scorer. I've thought that all along. His biggest challenge was going to be physically what that regime looked like in Korea. He's come through that, mate, with flying colours. So he'll be a good investment for any football club in Asia, I believe. Turkey, maybe, possibly. That kind of countries.
Yeah, okay.
Interesting. We'll see where Adam Taggart ends up. Let's hope he continues to bang the goals in. Wellington Phoenix said to be considering establishing a W League team and basing it in Wollongong. Yeah. Is that good for our women's competition? And do we know what's happening with the Phoenix license? Has it been extended, or are we still waiting on that? There's an awful lot of unknown.
I don't think we know anything. But you know what? One thing I will give to Wellington Phoenix, it's good that they want to bring in a women's team now. Yeah. Will it eventuate? Will they be allowed to? I don't know. But it's another 25 positions of professional type football for these girls, and I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I think. Look, Simon, I think Wellington Phoenix are at least being proactive, aren't they? I mean, we've got a Women's World Cup in 2023. They're obviously looking and are having discussions with Wollongong because potentially they'll need to come back next season for a hub scenario, which will be in New South Wales. But again, like, can we not or should we not be talking about the expansion of Australian potential teams also? And again, not being disrespectful to Wellington Phoenix, I think they've been fantastic. They've been proactive, and Women's World Cup, we just got to keep on growing.
Have the Kiwi girls qualified for Women's World Cup? Just a quick question.
Well, normally when you host a World Cup, you automatically qualify.
Yeah, so that's why they want to join in now for their own interests. once again, come on, man.
Just a final one, and sticking with the women's game before we move overseas, the Matildas coach identity still unknown. We believe the race is down to two with Carolina Morazze, who we talked about last week, I think, the Italian coach, and Tony Gustafsson, the former American women's national team assistant coach. They've got a training camp coming up in November, so you'd imagine that they'd want a new coach in situ by then. Very interesting story on FTBL in the last 24 hours. A couple of former Matildas have spoken out, saying that the current crop of players must accept whichever coach is chosen. And that sort of hints at a player power issue within the Matildas. They have gone through a fair few coaches over the last few years. What's your take on all that, Maury?
I like that. Again, I didn't read that story, Simon, but I did read a couple of other stories in terms of both candidates and the way that the story was presented. And you've got to be careful because it's a story. You don't know whether it's factual. But we need to see what coach the players like best. Now, Spides, we've been involved in football a long time, and I cannot remember at any stage in my career where, as a player, I've been asked what I thought of a potential coach coming in.
No, 100% Maury, mate. Look, the players are what picking the national team coach. I'm like, come on, guys, spare me, will we? Just get on board. Mate, the governing body needs to pick who they think will be the best manager for this current crop of players and for the future of the game. Full stop. And the women players, I shouldn't call them women, I should just say players, they just need to accept it. And if they don't accept it, it is their right to actually say, no, I don't want to play for my national team. That's it.
Yeah, yeah. But like I said, there has been an undercurrent of this kind of talk around about the Matildas for some time, and that player power. But governance, FFA, they need to have their own strategy. It needs to align with what they believe is the future for the Matildas, and the players just fall into line.
Indeed. I don't think you can get into a situation where you have the employees choosing the identity of their own boss. I tell you, I might have chose one or two different ones down the years, that's for sure. Let's head overseas for our next segment. London Calling.
London Calling.
Let's talk a wee about Barcelona and Leo Messi's comments in particular on social media regarding the Luis Suarez departure to Atletico Madrid. And incidentally, in case you missed it, Suarez on debut scored two and assisted another Kel Surprise. Messi said Suarez deserved a send-off better than he got, but that nothing surprises me anymore at Barcelona. It sounds to me, boys, as though Leo is still not a happy camper at Camp Nou.
No, he's not happy, is he? But it didn't seem to worry him too much on the field. They won comfortably 4-0. But as for Suarez, look, he's right. He probably deserved a much better farewell than what he got. But in football, we've seen that many, many times. And Suarez as a player has gone to an opportunity that he thinks suits him. And obviously, clearly, it does. And under Simeone, he's going to be a real threat. And I think Atletico is going to be a real threat this year.
Is there any way back, Mori, for Messi at Barca?
Look, he's still obviously angling, isn't he? Mate, when he swings, he doesn't miss. he swings, he doesn't miss. But, you know, for Suarez, again, he's a football player. He wants to play. He wants to be loved. Strikers are a little bit special that way in terms of that feeling. Great business by Atletico. I think it was it 6 million spides?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
What like 6 million? Great bit of business, but Leo Messi, definitely an unhappy camper.
Indeed. Two shock results over the weekend in Europe. First of all, Bayern Munich's 32-match unbeaten run was ended by Hoffenheim in some style as well by 4-1. That was their first defeat since December 2019 against Borussia Mönchengladbach. And Manchester City, yes. In the Premier League.
We'll talk about Bayern first and then we'll just handball a Man City one over to you.
Okay, well, Claude, you talk about Bayern first then.
What I think's happening at the moment, Simon, is there's a lot of matches in Europe. There's games happening every Wednesday, Saturday. And you know what? These guys are very good players, like great players. But even the toll on these players is ridiculous at the moment. And I think you're going to get a lot of inconsistent matches this year where the players just can't back up. And I think that's clearly happened. You know, Bayern's come off a Super Cup win against Seville, which was a cracking game that went into extra time.
So it's a bit of a Champions League stroke Super Cup hangover for Bayern Munich. Are you offering up the same excuse for Man City?
And off to you we go. What do you think? So tell us, Simon, what do you think happened to Man City on the weekend?
I'll give you a very succinct answer. They were crap. And defensively in particular, there remains huge issues for me. I mean, the game against Leicester, and Leicester have beaten City three or four times in the last few years. And there's no secret to the way they play against City. They exploit the high defensive line with the pace of Jamie Vardy, who just seems to have a field day every time he plays against Manchester City. And I wonder sometimes whether there's an obstinacy about Pep Guardiola. Far be it from me, Mori, to question one of the great coaches or managers of world football. But defensively, City still look very, very threadbare. Yes, they've added Nathan Ake. They're about to add Ruben Dias for $65 million. I'm not sure he's City's first choice centre-back, incidentally. I think they wanted Koulibaly. But there's still issues in the full-back areas as well. Mendy and Walker are great going forward. But defensively, they make mistakes. And both of them coughed up penalties at the weekend.
I'm going to say three penalties, Simon. Yep. And again, we know how Leicester play. We know Vardy, the way that he plays in terms of how hard he works getting in between central defenders and fullbacks. Three penalties to lose 5-2 at home, and for Man City to be a title hope this season, you can't be losing 5-2 at home, can you?
Guys, how much do you think this no crowd thing is really playing a part? Because if you have a look, there's a lot of away teams winning matches around the world as well.
Well, the old joke at Man City, of course, is that we got no fans, so that shouldn't make a difference. Which is complete cosmology. Hey,
you've been a player as well, so you know how important when you play at home in particular that support can be, and how it can be that 12th man. But sometimes it also puts added pressure. If you're at a big club and you're playing at home and after 15, 20 minutes you've not scored a goal, that can also work against certain players that maybe don't have that tough mentality. So look, that part's not there in the game at the moment. So some players may be playing with a little bit more freedom. Certainly teams playing away from home are maybe not countering that pressure, that atmosphere that maybe they would normally experience. So very interesting, but you touch on away teams going, performing, doing well. Fans definitely play a major part, and we need to see our fans back in the stadium sooner rather than later.
I want to ask you a question, boys, about that specifically. From your own playing days, you both played for massive clubs. Maura, you for Rangers, Spider, you for AC Milan. When the team was struggling and the fans started to get a bit restless, did that transmit its way through to the players?
It's horrible, mate. For 12, 15 months at Rangers, mate, I was struggling, and I played a good match and I'd play one stray pass. And when you got 50,000 fans, and they're not necessarily booing, but it's it sounds like a boo, mate. It's certainly not great for the confidence. Mate, it's so, so tough. And the big clubs, mate, they want to be entertained, Simon. They like, if you've not scored after 15 or 20 minutes, mate, they're on your case big time. Really, really tough.
Yeah, and you know what the funny thing is, Maury? Like, when you play for these big clubs, like, everyone expects you to just go out there and win 3 and 4-0. It's incredible. And I always knew at Milan, the longer the game went at 0-0, it was like, oh, shit. There's a counter-attack coming here. There's a counter-attack coming here somewhere, you know, because the crowd's actually urging you on to go score. And then all of a sudden, you're pushing numbers forward that you shouldn't be pushing, and the counter-attack's wide open. So I think it plays a massive part. I really do. And I think you can see it worldwide at the moment with what's happened with no crowds, that the away team almost has an advantage.
Let me ask you about the other big talking points that really had an impact over the weekend. And that's this new handball rule, which caused a portion of consternation. Particularly two decisions, one in the Crystal Palace Everton game for the handball given against Joel Ward, which in my opinion is just absolutely ludicrous. And similarly, the handball given against Eric Dier in the Spurs Newcastle game that earned Newcastle.
And even the Man United one. It's like, I'm still not very, very clear with the whole handball rule, Simon, because the Man United penalty, there was a handball incident. Because it didn't directly lead to the goal, there was a chance for the ball to be cleared, and then it wasn't cleared, and then end up being called back. For me, the VAR, I really can't get my head around the handball situation. We've seen some poor decisions. And I just think we're still guessing week in, week out, although we'll get the referee's official come on and say what should happen. But the thing is, these things consistently aren't happening. So coaches are like, well, hang on, we've been presented to at the start of the season about what the rules are going to be, but we're now getting different outcomes come weekend. What's happening?
Yeah, it's ludicrous. And the managers are going to start blowing up even more. I think we're going to get protests after the match. They're not even going to do the press conferences anymore because they're just going to get themselves into trouble.
Yeah, fine.
The other thing that's causing a bit of consternation in the UK at the moment, in England in particular, is this spike in COVID cases. It's starting to affect clubs with their preparations. David Moyes, in particular, the West Ham manager, had to go into self-isolation after testing positive ahead of the Carabao Cup tie between West Ham and Hull City, along with two of his players, Issa Diop and Josh Cullen. Moyes had to coach from home against Wolves this weekend. This really is sort of unprecedented.
4-0 though, Simon.
Yeah, well, maybe they're better off without them. Interesting stuff. In terms of Asia, the Champions League guys in Asia thrown into disarray. Al Hilal thrown out for failing to name the required number of players, which is 13. One or two clubs have already been thrown out of the competition. AFC saying they're still looking at a final date of the 19th of December. So they're also looking at centralised hubs for next year's competition as well, which suggests that they're not too confident that even next year this coronavirus is going to be under control. This is going to be mighty difficult, isn't it, for them to get this competition finished by December?
Very difficult.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I think so. We've touched on it a couple of times. I just can't see how, with all the uncertainty, how it can be played out. I think also, was it Mitch Duke, Simon, that scored the goal that got his team through to the round of 16? But I just don't know and can't see how this season's ACL can be completed.
Well, I'll tell you an interesting one is the J-League clubs in particular are going to be a very hard hit because they've got to complete their domestic fixtures at the same time as their Champions League fixtures, which at the moment looks like it could be played in a hub in Qatar. I reckon all the groups eventually will be completed in Qatar, not the whole competition in Qatar. So they would need a squad there for the Champions League and a squad at home for the J-League, which is almost impossible, isn't it? And that makes a mockery in some ways of the competition.
Well, the only thing about the J-League is, Simon, there's no relegation this year.
That's true.
Yeah. But it's like a little bit, we've seen the Champions League when it completed just the last season, Simon, but domestic season was finished, wasn't it? So it didn't, you know, it didn't distract them all. But to have two different squads, potentially, again, I don't see how that is possible. And certainly some real challenges in terms of scheduling, not only now, but maybe moving forward as well.
Tough times for football the world over. Final one in this segment. What a great story this is. Kazumura, at 53 years of age and 210 days, played in the J-League for Yokohama against Kawasaki Frontale, breaking the oldest player record by 8 years. He's now played in five different decades. This is incredible. I'm still hanging on to hope that I could make it as a professional because I'm younger than Kazu.
Yeah, you keep forgetting to tell everyone about your hamstring that come off the bone, son, when you went for a gallop.
But is there not a rule, Spides? Is there not a rule in it? So, I mean, that's a tremendous story at 53 years of age, still on. Coming up 45, that was a lot I think I'll do right now is play a game. But they in Japan, then unless a player retires themselves, the club don't retire the player, or there's some kind of rule. Simon, have you heard anything about that?
I think it's more to do with the traditional sort of hierarchy of Japanese society because Kazu, who of course is nicknamed King Kazu, is so revered in Japan. I don't think Yokohama, the club with whom he's been with since 2005, I don't think they are ever going to tap him on the shoulder and say, hey, it's time to hang the boots up. I think it's up to him. And he said he wants to play until he's 60, Spider. Can you imagine that?
All right, man. I would understand if he was a goalkeeper and he didn't have to run.
Yeah. Yeah. What about a young central defender, mate? I'd be loving that. Eh?
Oh, there'd be no runs in behind there, would there?
Oh, mate. Just make he's dropping deep. That's it.
Can I ask you boys, again, a question regarding your own playing careers? And obviously, Father Time catches up with everybody. But is there a specific point when you're in a game where you think, you know what, I'm done? Or is it a gradual decline? I'm fascinated by that as a person, of course, who wasn't a professional footballer.
Nah, Simon, for a goalkeeper, Spider will give you his story. And it will be different to a player as such. But my 2 years in the Premiership, and I was only 32 when I went to the Premiership. But if I was not 100%, and I struggled with injuries in the Premiership, if I wasn't 100%, I knew that I was going to be exposed because you're up against pace, you're up against power. Even the so-called lesser names could embarrass you. But, you know, you physically, you know when you're not capable at that level. And it's not a nice feeling. It's not a nice feeling, but you do know whether or not you can cut the mustard at the level. And there comes a time. Some people hang on. Some players hang on a little bit longer. But certainly for me, you know, returning to Australia was at a good age. It was something that I was comfortable with. But to stay long in the Premiership, I couldn't have done it physically. And the way that the game had gone, it was already speed beyond what I had.
Yeah, mine was similar, Maury. I ended up with an injury, and I just couldn't train 100% anymore. I had to change the way I was getting up and stuff like that. And you could actually see when you're playing at that level that I actually couldn't compete anymore with my peers. So the guys that I was competing with to play ahead of them, I just couldn't compete anymore. So I actually wasn't enjoying training because I couldn't train at 100% anymore, and I just knew it was time. So, like you said, you know, you dropped back and played in the A-League, which, you know, no disrespect, but it's a big drop back from where you were playing. I could have actually done the same, but I was sort of over the training. I was done with it because it was too hard to actually adapt to everything. So it was just time, and you knew it was time. And I'm glad I finished on my terms instead of actually being told, mate, 100%. That's it. Yeah.
100%. Yeah, I did the same, boys. Torn hamstring at 52, Abbotsford Juniors. I lasted 5 minutes of my second comeback game. So I think that's God's way of saying I'm too old.
I still, for the life of me, have no idea how you've done your hamstring, mate. I thought you had to have some speed to do a hamstring injury in the first place.
It was trying to stretch a leg that hadn't been stretched that far in probably about 30 years. That's what did it.
Yeah. Well, move your feet, son.
That was the tricky bit. Okay, let's move on to our final segment today. And we've got another great guest in Footballers' Lives.
Footballers' Lives.
Well, our special guest today began his career in the early with the great Melbourne Knights team, where he was a part of two NSL championship winning squads. From there, he moved overseas to Salernitana in Italy, then Baden in Switzerland, and briefly Stoke City in England. His longest spell, though, was with Manchester City, for whom he made over 150 appearances in a six-year stay before joining Leicester in 2004. 3 years later, he came home to round out his professional career with Brisbane Roar. He won 23 caps in a decade-long international career with the Socceroos and was known, I think it's safe to say, for his tough tackling and rather uncompromising style. It's a big podcast welcome to Danny Tiazzo. How are you, Pete?
Good guy, yeah, excellent.
Great to see you, mate. I imagine you might have watched the Manchester City Leicester game overnight. What did you make of all that?
Yeah, it was disappointing. You think a Man City side with the quality they got shouldn't have conceded 5 goals, but it's just the times of football at the moment with all the COVID and no fans in the stadium. I think it could be a little bit different for the players as well.
Yeah. And Danny, what are you up to these days in terms of your life? What work do we find you doing?
Well, at the moment, I'm residing up on the Gold Coast, loving it up here, enjoying the beautiful weather and the lifestyle, and just helping out my wife with her little education business, and also coaching my young fellas under 14 side up at Logan Lightning.
Teach, just a quick one, mate, for the people that can't see. I love the shirt you got on, Red Bull shirt. You should have just put Jaeger on the top of it, and it'd be Jaeger Red Bull. And mate, keep the sponsors happy, mate. Let me tell you, we done the old fashioned get together last night. Vinnie Grella's popped into town, and we give it a good tilt. And that shirt just brought memories of what I shouldn't be doing late at night.
That's okay. We're old and retired. We can do those things now.
Thanks for filling us on your sorry there, Spider. That's great. Daddy, let's go back to the beginning of your pro career and that wonderful Melbourne Knights team in the mid-90s. Some team you had. I just want to reel off some of the names. Viduka, Juric, Horvat, Buljubasic, Marth, Marisic, Kovacevic, Javinski, Spiteri, Biskic, Fausto Di Amici. Some great memories and some great players as well in that era.
Yeah, and one boy you missed out as well was Joe Simonich as well. He came through Melbourne Knights as well. So, yeah, the amount of talent we had back in that old Melbourne Knights days was phenomenal. And, like I said, we had a good bunch of boys who were young, hungry and desperate to make a career for themselves. So that was a great stepping stone for a lot of us boys at the time in the old NSL.
Is that team underrated in terms of the way that it's remembered or not remembered in the modern era?
You'd think so. I think the old NSL has been brushed well and truly under the carpet for a long time. But yeah, again, the game moves forward, players come and go, and again, eras and squads come and go as well. Again, like the Sydney United, the Sydney FC at the moment. Again, they're doing very well, and they'll be a team that will get recognised for a little bit. But then after about 10, 15 years' time, they'll be forgotten about as well, and the next best thing will come along, and that will be talked about. So, but that's such a footballer's career, and that's how it works.
Your initial steps overseas, Danny. Rather tentative, is probably safe to say. Just 11 games for Salernitana. He didn't feature at all, according to the official records for Baden. A lone spell at Stoke. Was it a tough learning school? I know in particular that the fans at Salernitana were quite demanding, let's say.
It was definitely a very big learning curve for me coming from Melbourne Knights, where the supporters were quite intimidating and, mainly for other teams back in Melbourne. But making that move after the Olympics over to Italy, to a Serie B squad, Salernitana, it was a bit of a culture shock, even though I've got Italian background and stuff. I was still classed as a foreigner. And, our supporters at the time, we weren't travelling so well. So when they turn up to your training ground, 3,000 strong, abusing you and, making it hard for you to train. And, it was tough, especially because I've never experienced anything like that. I know one game we came back and they lined the road coming back from Foggia, going back to our club back in Salerno, and they blocked the road and all the ultras come on the bus and abused every single player and the president of the club. So that's how much control they had of the team and the club as well. So, again, it was amazing and a different experience that, most players don't come across.
Teets, touching on that, because obviously, mate, our weekly coffees are not happening now because I'm in Scotland, but we've had many chats over the years. But your time at Salernitana, you touched on that incident where the supporters actually come onto the bus and gave every single spray, or sorry, gave a spray to every single player, but they got to you. And you were okay, you told me that time.
Yeah, well, they did. They sort of come up to me and sort of said, hey, canguro, which is like kangaroo in Italian sort of way, and said, hey, you're okay. You're putting in the effort and trying to work hard. And they show that every time I got a couple of minutes here and there at the time that I gave it my all and really dug in. So I think they appreciated they had that fight behind me. But all the rest of the players, I think they thought they were on a bit of a holiday and a bit of a jolly up. So I was safe, at that first stage, when they did come on the bus. So again, it was nerve-wracking for me. But end of the day, they gave me a bit of a pardon, which was good.
I don't think anybody, Danny, could accuse you of lacking in effort or fight. You came to England, as I say, first of all with Stoke, but you got sort of your big break, I suppose, when signing for Manchester City in 1998, a fee of £300,000. City, obviously, a club that was a lot different then to the one it is now. And you had Danny Allsopp there as well, as another Australian. Did that help you settle, and how did that move come about?
Well, basically, when I got the loan move out of Italy, it was actually Kevin Muscat's agent. I spoke to Muscat at the time. He was over at Crystal Palace, and his agent actually got me the loan move over to Stoke City. And I was at Stoke City for about 7-8 months and played out the remaining season there and had a really, really good 7-8 months there. And, we played Man City a couple of times. I had a few people come out and watch me play, and they were looking for a left-sided player, and that's how basically the move came about. I went back on the off-season, and they contacted me agent at the time, and ended up making the move to City. So again, it was I didn't really know a lot about City. I sort of researched when I knew they showed a bit of interest and realised, you know, the size of the club and the supporter base I had. So it was, again, even though that was a step backwards for me at the time because I went back into the old second division because they got relegated that season, I thought, you know what, it's going to be a great opportunity for me, maybe make some inroads and start getting some first-team football at a big club.
Yeah. And that's the thing, Teets. You've shown by the way you've played your whole career that you weren't scared to go to places that you thought were great opportunities. And that's a desire I think a lot of players these days. I know, again, we've spoken about this before when I've been up at the Gold Coast about the young players and their desire to actually roll the sleeves up and work to actually get something. And another one, you're a perfect example of it. And, mate, let me tell you, Melbourne Knights are well and truly recognised in the sporting history of Australian football.
Yeah, like they should be. But again, yeah, like we've spoken before, Spider and Maury, and, again, I think it has to come down to the player, but also the person who's representing the player as well. You can't just look at dollar signs. You've got to look and see where's the best place for this kid if he's leaving Australia and going overseas, for sure.
Yeah, it's a play. Pete, you're obviously coaching your son Harley, mate. What are you seeing? What are you seeing on the ground level in terms of the positives, in terms of the talent of players, and potentially maybe the education of what is required to be a professional footballer? What are you seeing at the ground level?
If I was to be brutally honest, it's disappointing. Now that I'm involved in coaching younger kids, and I have been for a number of years now, and just seeing the progress and just being in that environment where everyone's turning around and saying, oh, why aren't we producing better kids? Again, it all comes down to grassroots football. All these clubs and coaches, they've got all their licenses, but they haven't had the experience of telling the kids the right information, every training session, every game, what it takes to become a top-level footballer as well. The pressure of, you've got to perform every week or else you're going to spend a little bit of time on the bench. We're all very nice and giving everyone that time on the field. We're not grading the boys at club football right as well, just because you've been there and your parent might be in the committee and his son has to be in a certain side. Again, you need to build a pyramid, and that has to come in junior football. If you've got two or three weaker kids in your team, at the end of the season, you need to move those on and find three stronger boys and keep on developing that side. So when they get to an age of 17, 18, that side will be very complete and be a very strong bunch of boys, So I see that week in and week out at the moment, and the way they're coaching the boys, again, they're coaching the boys one way, which is curriculum-based, but then when it comes to games, that goes out the window. All I see now is long balls, kicking the ball as far as you can, not trying to play, not trying to create that smartness, that awareness of playing out of the back. And again, you need to do that, you need to do that. And we're not doing that, week in and week out. And that's why we're not creating top footballers.
Danny, that's a strength of character you needed a lot with Manchester City. If I can take you back to those days in the third division, it was known as League Two in those days, or Division Two in 98-99. I remember that season very, very well as a fan because I went to most of those games, places that Manchester City didn't normally play at. And it lifted the level of the opposition to play against the big club and to try and beat the big club. How difficult was that as a player for that club at that time? Because the expectations were that City shouldn't be in that league. You were expected to win every single game. And it was a damn tough year, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, I'm always a very competitive footballer, but when we went to some of these grounds and the fields were mud patches, and you know, you got 6'5", you know, big brutes trying to boot the hell out of you week in and week out. And then vice versa, when they came to our ground and they played on an immaculate surface, a nice big stadium, they stepped up their game immensely. And we had to basically work so hard that season to get ourselves out. I think if we didn't get out first season, I think it could have been a different story for the progress of the club, you know, even up to, so again, that's how hard and how the pressure was on us week in, week out. And again, the boys who didn't dig in that year, mate, you know, the City supporters used to boo the hell out of a lot of boys who didn't show that desire and hunger to compete every week, you know. So that's why I always, you know, was always in good stead, because I'd get sent off, I'd punch, I'd kick. And that was a Manchester supporters' way, you know. They wanted to dig in and fight every weekend, you know. And I was the same sort of player as what the supporters were.
I know, because I was one of those fans, Danny, who was probably giving the players abuse at that particular moment. You had lots of highs and lots of lows with City. You won the Player of the Year award, got promoted into the Premier League, that famous day at Blackburn, where really Blackburn should have beaten City. I think they hit the woodwork four times and City ended up winning by 4-1. You played in Manchester derbies. You marked David Beckham. And you also, let's be delicate about this, you had a couple of disciplinary issues as well during your time at Main Road. I remember watching you, a game against Blackburn Rovers, you came off the bench and I think you'd been on the pitch, was it 3 or 4 minutes? And I think you two-footed David Thompson in the groin and got a red card. Do you remember some? Pick out some of the highs and lows for us, Danny, of your time at City.
Again, that was I was just privileged that, you know, that I played at that time at City, and the roller coaster ride of that club was unbelievable. You know, by being promoted 2 years on the bounce, then getting relegated, then back up again, you know, getting play of the season, getting sent off most years, had a good bunch of boys where we could go and have a drink after a game and have a bit of a laugh as well. Again, I wouldn't change it, you know, Again, I know the money is crazy now at City and all that, but I wouldn't change my time. When I played, I think I had the best of both worlds, done okay financially, but then also the team camaraderie and the boys we had at the club and the players I played with as well. It was unbelievable, you know, and the coaches that we had as well. It was just a great experience. Yeah, like I said, there's that many, you know, highs and lows. But again, yeah, David Thompson, yeah, I actually bumped into him a few years ago and apologised to him, you know, even though I apologised, you know, after the game to him. But yeah, he still remembered that. And we had a bit of a laugh about it a few years ago when they came to Adelaide and had that little indoor tournament against Liverpool United and a few of those boys. So, but yeah, it was a, you know, a great time in my career and thoroughly enjoyed it.
Teets,
I'm surprised it took you 3 or 4 minutes, Teets, to top him.
Teets, do you miss anything? I mean, we've all been players before and we've all enjoyed the, you know, the dressing room and the banter, obviously playing in front of full stadiums and that. Is there anything that you really miss, or you're quite content with where you are now?
No, I'm very content. I think initially when you do sort of finish your playing career, you wish, you know, that you probably, you know, maybe would have done a couple of things different. That environment always, to be around the players, was always something that I really thoroughly enjoyed, you know, whether it was with club football, international duties. I just loved being around the boys and having a bit of a joke and a laugh. But I think, you know, as you get a little bit older, I think you really, really get over sort of, you know, the intensity and the work rate and, you know, the effort that you had to put in to make it at that level. You know, I think I'm fully content of what I've done. And, you know, like I said, I can look back now finally and say, you know what, yeah, I was a little bit mad at times, but, you know, I wouldn't change it for the world.
And physically, Teets, physically, I know that you did end up having a couple of injuries. I think I remember a game against Turkey where Mark Schwarzer come out and went to punch the ball, and I think he caught your jaw instead. Over 35s, Musgrave. Craig Moore plays a little bit long, too long a ball. A still enthusiastic Danny Tiato. Talk us through what happened there. I felt terrible.
Basically it was your fault, Maury. You've just overhit a long one. My legs, and again, it's just my stupid enthusiasm that tried to get me toe on the end of it as the keeper come out and caught me very, very sweet and snapped every ligament and had microfractures. What was that, mate?
Was that your worst injury?
That was my worst injury, mate. That's after I finished playing football. For a fair few years. So I've got to thank you for that. But again, they can replace me easy. So when I'm about 60, new replacement will go in. And I'll be right for another few years.
Mate, we still have
lucky. You had the golf buggy to get down to the local to have a drink. You two.
You know what? Actually, we actually did have a beer after the game because my knee was a little sore. Yeah, and we ended up we actually had one at the clubhouse, and then Maury and our late friend Mark actually drove us back to my house. We had a couple of beers here. Maury contacted Damien Voss, who was an Aussie boy who was over at Sunderland but working here at Hope Island, and got straight into him and ended up sorting me out quite quickly. So it was fun times, but I wasn't doing much during the day. So leg up for a few months wasn't too bad.
Sorry, mate.
Danny, go on.
Tell us, mate, you've played at some great stadiums and you've played at some dungeons, mate. Tell us the best stadium you've played at and tell us the biggest dungeon you've been to.
The dungeons, there was a fair few back in the old second division. I think we played at Grimsby. I think the only good thing was probably the fish and chips probably after the game.
I played there. What a dungeon.
it was pretty dodgy, but... But again, I think between playing in the Premier League against, in some of those venues were unbelievable, Anfield, United, Newcastle. Again, all those Premier League sides, the grounds were crazy, the supporter base was good. But I think even with the national side, we've played in some good venues as well, when we've been to South America as well. You know how crazy the South Americans are, the atmosphere they created. I don't think, the hairs on the back of your neck would stand up when we play in South America because they're just so mad. So I think those stadiums over there were unbelievable as well. So, there was so many stadiums that we played in that, again, that hair on the back of your neck would stand up. And, you never forget those things.
I was there at Grimsby that particular day, Danny, where you drew 1-1. I know Spencer Pryor scored, who's another ex-City boy who's now living in Australia. I've got a little story to tell you. You probably don't know this. Well, you definitely don't know this. But I actually was reporting for ITV in the season 01-02 when City were in the Championship under Kevin Keegan. And I know wasn't your favourite manager to play under, and he certainly wasn't my favourite manager to deal with as a journalist either. A game against Watford, and you actually won the Man of the Match award, and it was my job to give you the big Jeroboam of champagne, if you remember, that Nationwide dished out for the player of the match. And such was the poor relationship between ITV and Manchester City at the time that Keegan refused to allow you to come and accept that Man of the Match award. So I gave that Jeroboam of champagne to a mate of mine because it was in my possession, and he kept it for 10 years and drunk it the day that City won the title in 2011-12. So I'm sure you'd be glad to hear that it went to a good home and finally got drunk. I want to ask you a quick question before we move on to some Twitter questions, Danny, about the best player you played with. And I'm not just talking about, obviously, Socceroos, Mark Viduka, Harry Kewell, etc., but at City, you play with the likes of Paolo Wanchope, George Weah, Andre Kanchelskis, Nicholas Anelka, the late Mark Vivian Foe. Do you have a favourite or two from your playing days that you thought, wow, he's a bit special?
The boys you mentioned, they were quality as well. We had Sean Wright Phillips as well that came through as a younger boy. Ali Benabia as well, the Algerian international as well. He was phenomenal. Al Berkovic at the time. And then we had, Sean Goda. Again, I was pretty privileged that we had, again, as much as we had a lot of turnover in those 6 years that I was there, I got to play with so many top players. Goalkeeper-wise, we had Nicky Weaver at the start, David James, David Seaman, Peter Schmeichel came in as well. So we had that many top boys that were, world class. That again, I think it was, a privilege for me to be involved at a club like that, and I got to experience that. So, and again, and then when we opened up the city of Manchester as well, when we played against Barcelona, that Barcelona side had Ronaldinho, Overmars, Puyol, Xavi, the whole lot, So to actually, get on the field and play against a side like that in my career was something very special as well. And like I said, when you look back, I think all the boys that played at that level, it's like a dream basically. Now that you look back, you think, oh, did I do all that? Did I play against all those? I get bagged a fair bit, but a lot of people don't realise. The amount of the talented boys that I played with and but again a lot of people forget about that, and all they see is the leg breaking little bald headed gnome.
Well, I tell you what, Man City fans still remember you fondly for that 100% effort and never say die attitude. And I certainly remember your time very fondly at Main Road, maybe apart from that tackle by David Thompson, which I know led to a fallout between you and Kevin Keegan. Anyway, we are running short of time a little bit, Danny. We could go on for hours talking about your career. We've got a couple of Twitter questions. I want to start with this one from Carl Burney, who wins our question of the week. Congratulations, Sir Carl. $100 Outback meal voucher coming your way. Manchester City is a vastly different club nowadays, says Carl. What has remained the same or recognisable from your time? Is there anything?
Probably when they wear a blue top, and that's about it. Not even the...
Simple as that.
Again, it's vastly changed. Yeah, the amount of money and the players and the way the club's gone. Again, it's huge. It's a world brand now. It's a leading in the world game. So again, it's changed. Unrecognizable basically. So yeah, it would be nice to go back there one day. I know I've got a couple of ex teammates who are still involved at the academy level over there. So hopefully in the near future, and we can fly about Europe again. I'd like to get over there and check it out.
Okay. Arto Harkonnen asks, do you feel your reputation as a tough defender was exaggerated? And do you think it preceded you a bit unfairly in games?
Not really. I think it was all pretty plain and simple that, I was very competitive, and that was the edge that I had of my game, that every time I played against, teams, they knew that, the player that I was marking always knew in the back of his head that, I could take him out at any time sort of thing, and or else I could get sent off at any time as well. So, again, that did follow me around, and that was part and parcel of the way I played it in those years. You can't do it at this day and age.
Okay, and the last couple, we got one from Ben Archer. What's the funniest chant or sledge you heard in your career? And one from Keats Treats, NSL or A-League, which do you prefer?
Sledges and all of that, mate. I don't know how many times I got abused from the sidelines when we played opposition sides. It was, mate, they're actually too rude to even say, because I got pelters, Again, when I sort of had longish sort of hair called Gypo, like Gypsy, a fair bit, and a few swear words thrown in. And I was to say between A-League and NSL, it's a tough one. The NSL was semi-pro at the time. We did have some great players coming through. The game did evolve. The A-League, they're trying to push it in the right direction. It's just unfortunate that after the boys won the Asian Cup, we should have really progressed and kicked on the A-League from then, but hasn't. Sort of stopped and started. So again, I'd still like, and I don't want to bag the A-League, as well, but I'd really like to see the A-League really push on to another level. But But I'm a little bit disappointed the way everything's going in general. I know finances is a massive part of the game, and we just don't have it. But yeah, hopefully, yeah, you know, I'd like to see a bright future for kids here in Australia and our national side. But I think every parent with a young kid now has to look at their kids individually and work with them individually and try and get them to a level to eventually try and get them overseas at an early age. And again, that's disappointing because we want to try and create a great brand and a great league here in Australia. But at the moment, I can't see a lot of future moving forward, to be honest.
Okay. Anything to add, boys, before we finish?
Nah, Teets, absolute pleasure, mate. Great to hear these stories and great to reminisce of the times. I just want to know why you Victorians have all got white line fever.
Mate, you know what? It's because there was a lot of Italian, Croatian dads that used to beat us when we were young, and so we had to be pretty tough. I think that was our... that's our attitude, you know, I think the Victorian boys.
Brilliant.
Danny... Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. And, good to see you around the traps when we're able to travel once again. And thanks for sharing some wonderful memories and stories with us on our podcast today. Cheers, mate.
Cheers, Tom. Cheers, thank you very much. Cheers, Greece, and all the best, Maury, over there in Scotland, pal. And hopefully see you soon, guys. Take it.
Cheers,
take
cheers, mate.
Cheers,
bud. Cheers.
And that is us for another week. Thanks to all of you who downloaded us, over 17,000 in total of our various episodes so far, and we're now well over 1,500 followers on Twitter as well. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, and we'll see you same time, same place next week. Until then, bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.